Hey.
Good evening, Octane Addicts. Welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on internetarchive.org, and on a number of podcast platforms. Our previous shows cover a wide range of IMSA celebrities, famous drivers, the forces behind the scenes, and the folks who have gotten their hands dirty all these years. And they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on the podcast from iHeartRadio Podcast, Google, Amazon, and Spotify, now reaching millions of fans. Download the app and listen on your phone, car radio, or computer. This one is a very special and timely event, a discussion of the 24 hours of Daytona, past and present. Tonight's show features some guys who were well-known fixtures at the 24. Rick Knoop, a free agent driver, always found the right car at the right place. Tommy Riggins, who has driven the widest variety of cars in the 24. And we have a guy who should be in the Pit Crew Hall of Fame, Jack Atkinson, who wrote the book on running teams from way back. And Bo Barfield, who is IMSA's race director in charge of running the races. And finally, Paul Decal Kelly, who set the record for fueling more IMSA cars and for more teams than is humanly possible. So, audience.
Thanks.
strap in with your horns and please mute your phones. If you have a question, just send it via chat and our producer will pass it along. If you're in the audience and you're a 24% there's noise participant, you're welcome to join the panel. Who wants to start this thing? Okay, at the very beginning, there was a track called Daytona. Who had it? Who drove on it first?
Who drove on it first?
This is Rick Knoop. I know I wasn't the first, but my first time there was 78, and I did, I think, 11 24 hours.
Wow.
Well, I'll just throw something in there, Dave Wallen here. In 1971, I think it was, I went with a couple of crazy guys and a VW Superbug that wouldn't go fast enough to get up on the banking about 98 miles an hour down on the apron. And we did, I don't know, 2 hours before it blew up. And after that, they instituted a rule where you had to qualify within some percentage of the fast guys because we were dangerous out there. So much for that story. Go on to some real races.
Sounds kind of like fun.
I first went to Dayton in 1959 for the Labor Day race of sports cars, and we ran the course clockwise. And NASCAR was not very happy about that, but we did it. And in the course of those races, there was a wreck between E.D. Martin's birdcage Maserati and Don Sessler driving an RSK. And coming off the banking in what's now Turn 1 for the NASCAR track, coming off the banking into the infield backwards to what we do it now. And they had a big wreck. And the outcome was that Mr. Brundy, who I worked for at that time, purchased that car and the trailer and the 59 Pontiac Bonneville station wagon. And that was the origin of Brumos Racing.
Wow. That's the beginning.
That's when it all starts. Yep.
The track was new in 59.
That's right. The first race was a NASCAR race in February of 59.
So this would have been the first sports car race on the new track.
Yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Well, I can't top that one. I was at the NASCAR race in 59, but I was just a little kid. Oh, my goodness. Okay, Rick says he's driven, what, 11?
Yeah, I think so, but I think five of those, hi, everybody, was with the Jim Busby Racing team. Right. And the first year I drove an ex George Dyer RSR that Busby had prepared, and it was 78. So I come in kind of later, but we ended up, I drove with a guy named Steve Earle, who started a lot of the vintage races, as you guys know, and Bob Aiken. And that started sort of an affiliation with Jim Busby because we were both about the same height. And I know Jim drove with Peter Gregg prior to that and underneath Jack's capable hands. So, but I did five races with Busby in a variety of cars, the Lola Mazdas, that BMW M1, which is one of the first GTX cars in 1980. And then I drove a Ferrari BB512 with the Damowitz and Pompelli. And I've had good finishes there, and but it was dark back then. You know,
yep.
My last Rolex was 06, and in 06 I drove a Daytona prototype. You didn't need any headlights. The place was like going to the Super Bowl game.
Strange, isn't it?
It has changed over the years.
Well, you could sit on the wall and teach yourself to recognize the cars and where they were on the track by the sounds they make. And going up or down the gears from what they were doing, so you'd know when to expect to see your car come past you to hit the stopwatch.
My first 24-hour was in 83. It's Tommy Riggins. I drove with Tom Neal and Wilcox, all from Jacksonville. Tom Neal was a truck dealer in town, and we built him a car, and then he invited me to drive with him, and it was basically a two-frame stock car, but made road raceable, and way under built for its class. We intended to run GTO, but when we went through tech, they had a rule that said you have to have 1 square foot of stock floor pan in the car. And, of course, we didn't have that. We went to a junkyard and got some and came back, and they wouldn't let us put it in. Said, no, you're already classified. So we had to run, AAGT or something. And actually, the race went really well. We ran the whole race at a consistent pace. We wound up finishing ninth overall. But we would have literally won GTO had we been classified appropriately. When we were on 10-inch steel wheels with stock car type tires and just a baseline 350 that had been blueprinted, but the car ran, performed flawlessly, and that was my first experience at the 24-hour. I've been entered in 13 of them, but I've driven in 12, and my last one was 2007.
That's a lot. At what point did you say, I'm just not going to do this anymore?
Well, you do it because, you know, it can be a source of income, but it got pretty old after the fifth or sixth one. You never say no to a ride, or a ride opportunity, but I was kind of burnt out on 24-hour races. That's just a long time to go just to get to the end.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Every 24-hour race I did, I only said afterward, I'll never do another one.
Speaking to the microphone.
Yeah. Hey, Tommy, I got a question here from the audience. Since you said you added 13 but only ran 12, what's the story on the 13th one?
Well, this would have been around, I don't know the exact year, around 2000. A team from Japan got put in touch with us. They needed a base to prep their car in the United States, and they were literally, truly from Japan. They had a Ferrari, something, I don't know what it was. And they came to the shop and did all the prep work and went down to the track, but they wanted me to be listed as a driver. They had an all-Japanese driver cast, but they wanted me to be listed as a driver because if there was some problem on the track, I guess the rule said that only the drivers could touch the car or something. And their drivers didn't even know what a screwdriver was. So
There's a lot of drivers like that.
Yeah, probably so. But anyway, so they had me listed. So if there was an issue that it needs somebody to go, you know, touch the car while it was still on course, that's why I was there. But I tested and practiced the car, but I never got in during the race. It was quite an experience. Obviously, you got a language difference because they only had one English interpreter, and he wasn't always around. But we got along pretty good. I had a couple of my guys from my shop help them, you know, crewing the car and stuff. And that's still a highlight of one of their, you know, experiences. But that's the story on my 13th that I never drove in.
I asked you the question about that. Having a member on that team that could go out, cross the fence, and touch the car was still then. Bo, is that legal now?
I don't even know. It wasn't always legal then.
Sorry about that. Say that again. I was just losing you.
Did you hear my question?
About you're talking about somebody going out to see about the car out on the course,
right?
Yeah. You know, it normally was where the driver could do anything he could do, and when you were in an FIA race, you had to have all the tools with you on the car. Whatever you wanted to do, you better have the tools there. It was all.
The reality is, in running today's races, we have such good facilities on the infield and the ability to bring cars back to the paddock through the infield that I guess it's much less necessary.
Right.
Have you ever seen anybody do it?
The need for that went away. There was no question about that.
There used to be another question for Bo Barfield from the audience. There used to be guys pushing the car across the finish line. I'm not sure if that happened in Daytona, but Sebring anyway. And guys having to come down to the pits and get tools and go back to work on the car themselves. What was the genesis of those rules? Do you remember how it used to be and what is it today?
Yeah, I definitely remember stories of, I think it was in the 60s that Dan Gurney might have used a starter motor, I think, to cross the line at Daytona. And I think they quickly wrote a rule to outlaw that. And so I think pushing the car across the line or anywhere on the track is definitely no longer permitted. And I haven't heard any stories of anybody carrying any tools around, and I think probably the drivers these days are a far cry from guys like Tommy, who's capable of going out there and working on the car himself probably to begin with.
Yeah, well, back in my time, you didn't have tools on the car, but somehow or another they would mysteriously appear on the ground if you needed something to work on it with.
Yeah, there was another whole thing that just doesn't happen anymore.
Thank goodness. But anyway, that was one of my experiences at the Japanese program.
I'm not even sure if the teams even put toolkits on the cars anymore. I haven't heard about them in a couple of years.
No. Well, you know, for a while we even had to carry spare tires.
Yeah.
And the FIA had a rule we had to be able to carry a certain size suitcase. you know, there have been over the years a lot of different rules for that sort of thing. But they come and they go.
Yeah, seems like now that pull off the cars just enough to make them throw a caution, and then they'll come get you and take you back to the garage area.
Now, another question for Bo from the audience. Used to be that the guys were able to change engines, transmissions. I'm not sure what kind of components. What's that rule today, and what did it used to be, if you remember?
Well, the thing I would say about that, it really comes to my mind, is in 76 at Daytona, in the 24-hour one, Union Oil delivered us water instead of gas and had to stop the whole race. There were at least three or four cars that changed either engine or transmission or both during that period. They were allowed to do that, and it was just a free-for-all. But most of the time in my early racing, you couldn't even replace a starter motor. You could take it out and fix it, but you could not replace it. It was the same for almost any component. You know, mostly that came into effect with transmissions, where people could normally change pieces of the transmission pretty quickly, but it doesn't happen anymore, I don't believe. First of all, they're more dependable and they last longer. It was so different back in the 60s and 70s, and even in the 80s a little bit, that I was out of it by then. So.
Jack might have knowledge about this, but I thought it at one time you could replace components on the engine, but you had to keep the original block.
Yeah, that's been a rule too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that rule was well into the 80s. I heard about that when I was over at Lamar.
Yeah. I remember one year they said you had to have two headlights, and if you make cars have four, at least two headlights and two driving lights. But if both of them went out on one side, you ended up taping them flashlight to the front of the car. You know, it was always the way around most of the way.
Hey, Rick Nuke, did you have any instances of changing engines or transmissions or anything like that?
No. I wouldn't be the right guy in that department, but I do remember I come in a little bit later, you know, in 78, where motor changes and RSRs and 935s and that sort of thing. I believe it was within the rule book then, but I might be stretching it. I'm not exactly sure, but I remember pretty distinctly in the years that I was there that full motor changes were happening. An awful lot of aggressive. Yeah.
You lost one of those titanium dry flaps in the banking with Daytona. We made it back to the pit. We ended up changing engine and transmission. We were allowed to do it. We did. We got back in the race.
God, I have something for Decal over there. He's been so quiet.
Where do you want me to begin? I did one car. 86, I did a car. And I'm actually looking at the picture. I did the Camel Lights car with a Mazda motor. And we had a exhaust come out the right side of the car. And after about an hour, I think the Supertramp muffler system was gone. So we just had a straight pipe coming out the side of it. The exhaust was hitting the trioval wall and bouncing into the pit lane. And whatever hearing we had there was about gone after that one. And I think everybody was kind of like throwing things at us, you know, or trying to find a really big baking potato or something like that. And I'm just to cut that shout out. Another one in which was happened a little bit later on was with the Porsche, 9/11. And we were doing really great. We were moving up and moving up and moving up. And also early in the morning, he says, the throttle just stuck wide open. And we're out of the race. I'm at the horse show. So me and the other guys run over to the horse show. And let's just say he was a little bit more than out of the race. The back end of the car was all the way up on the tire barrier. And I'm actually underneath the car looking up at it, you know, which was like, oh. Yeah, about a day or so later, a couple of guys got a hold of me and said, hey, Decal, you were on the CNN play of the day with your car crash. Looking up at the butt, I'm going like, oh, geez, thanks, guys.
That's one way to complain.
Yeah, it was not one of those. I was like, well, that, it was, I mean, yeah, it was nice. But, so.
Well, it sounded scary.
Yeah, a couple of things. I want to know what everybody else thinks about it. When you go through that tunnel nowadays, by turn one, and you see the middle, and you see that place, you know, what do you guys think when you go through that tunnel nowadays? And you come out the other side, and you see the banking and everything else. What kind of comes to mind when you see all that? I mean, we've been through there gazillions of times. You guys still get excited about being there?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah. I just remember
watching them race on the beach.
Nowadays, it's not that big a deal, but I remember the first time when the tunnel used to be over there at NASCAR 4.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I ever went into that speedway. This was back in the 70s when we had they called them Grand National then, but it turned into Busch Series cars. And I remember coming out of the tunnel. And all of a sudden, you see this big, massive, massive expanse of a racetrack. And that was quite an alarming sight when you see it in real person for the first time. Mm-hmm. That would be 75, 76, somewhere in there.
Hey, it's Bo here. It's interesting that you ask for a perspective when you drive through the tunnel and into a legendary place like the Daytona Speedway. I think that... something that I've noticed as I've gotten older in life is that your arrogance or your ego is inversely proportional to your experience level. Meaning the younger I was going into the Daytona International Speedway, I completely didn't appreciate it. And now every year that goes by, I drive in there and I'm in awe and I realize how lucky we are to be doing what we're doing. So I kind of reminded my team of that after this year's 24-hour. What we do is really awesome. How we do it is really awesome. And we're extremely lucky to be a part of what we do. So don't ever forget to take a moment and just take it all in and really appreciate it.
Bo, 100% agree with you. As I tell the younger guys, when you go through that tunnel and you see the speedway and the banking, you are now on center stage. No matter what race it is, I mean, you're on center stage when you go into that place. And the first people you go through there, you see where pit lane is. It's almost impossible to comprehend the sheer size of the place. Also, the history of the place. You know, respect the history of that place.
Yeah. That's the way I feel about Indianapolis. But that's a whole different animal.
Yeah.
I think for Daytona, for me, it's the changes in the track from when it first opens. It's
the
same track, but it isn't the same track. It just gets better and better and better. It's just a real showplace now. It's really pretty incredible. And when we go back a minute to replacing things on the course, the 73 race, which we kind of supposed to be talking about tonight, that was the first race I ever had to replace a windshield during the race. Of course, I know NASCAR, they didn't use glass windshields, haven't for years, but we were still using, basically production windshields. And for some reason, well, I know what the reason was, of course, we were trying to lighten the cost. They put a thinner windshield in the RSs, and of course, we had one of the two RS owners that were there that day. We were running the prototype, too. We were running the GT. So The center windshield, the seagulls just took care of it. They didn't like that.
Yeah.
And the sun came up and the seagulls got up and bam, bam, then went the windshield.
Bounce right.
And we had to take a windshield out of a streetcar in the infield to get, you know, to get keep going. And that was quite a, you know, and the other thing they had done is they had moved the mirror down because of the safety regulations, all the breakaway stuff they were putting in the cars at that time, for street cars mostly, and mounting the rear view mirror on the windshield. And of course, we had to manage to do that too, because windshield we took out of a car was not, didn't have, it had the mirror mounted up on the chassis. Fortunately, the factory had left that mounting point for the chassis-mounted mirror in the car, so by the time we went to Sebring, we had a chassis-mounted mirror, but we broke the mirror in Sebring, too. You know, some of the pieces of the track always get into you down there. So
what didn't you break at Sebring?
Huh?
What didn't you break at Sebring throughout the years?
Actually, you know, there were even some Porsches that had suspension problems, you know, things breaking off. No, you were going to break something, especially in the old original 5.2-mile course. It was just brutal. You know, there's so many places there where you were going catty corner across the square to concrete that made up the runways, and it was a real whoop-de-doo. You know, you still get a little bit of that going in turn one, at Sebring, but most of the rest of the track has been really smoothed out. The year it rained so hard, 64, I was with a 904 and Jack Ryan, and he lost the whole rear off the car out in the desert. And I'm in the pits, and what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I said, well, the only way you can continue is to go out there and find it, put it back on the car, and then keep racing. So we sort of, I can't remember who got in the car with it, but, you know, we knew one person couldn't put that through the spectrum back on the car. So we went out, found it, put it on the car, came back to the pit, and we got to the tank, and we kept racing. So, you know, you just never knew what was going to happen. They told me what three things for that matter. You know, 6-hour race is like a sprint race, and if anything speak of happens in a 6-hour race, like it was in June, May 4th, or May 8th, or the other side, where we had 6-hour races, you're usually done. You know, you pass it. But when it's 12 hours or 24, if you can fix it, you do. You know, that's it. When we went back to Daytona, the next time they had the 24-hour was in 75. They didn't have it in 74 because of the so-called fuel crisis. And we got down to the first hour. And the first time we really succeeded, we said, oh, let's just go in. I said, no, we can still win this race. So we fixed it and continued, and we won that race too. So, not a big deal.
And another question here from the audience.
Okay.
Now go ahead, finish up there, Jack.
Okay.
Yeah, the question, I guess, for both Rick Noop and Tommy Riggins. Had you driven there with and without the bus stop? What was the difference in driving when you had to make that little kink in the straight versus running flat out through the banking there?
Oh,
yeah, go ahead. Well, one of my memories from back in the day, I drove a Camaro for short track promoter Benny Corbin out of DeLand, but he wound up with that San Remo restaurant Camaro that ran in the 24 almost every year. And we got together and put it together and went down to Daytona. But I can remember going, and that was with no bus stop back then. And I can remember the first time I ever went down, come off the two and went down the back straightaway. You look way ahead of you, and it just looked like a wall standing in front of you. And it makes your chicken bone lift the first time. But once you get there and it ribbons on off and goes on around and then didn't take but just a few laps and that became old hat. But yeah, that's one of my early memories of running down there on the course without the bus stop.
Can I chime in on this one real quick?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it was like 81. I was working on a BMW M1 team with Diego Montoya and Albert Land. And we had this young Colombian driver named Roberto Guerrero.
Yeah.
Who, they were really good friends with Montoya. And Albert told me, he says, go with him in there, show him in there. And he saw the banking. And this was before the bus stop. And he goes, how do you drive the banking? I said, oh, it's real simple. When you're going into bank three, you take your right foot, your right hand, and you place it firmly on your foot. You hold the foot down all the way to the floor, and you close your eyes, and you hold on to the steering wheel. And he kind of looked at me like, you're out of your mind, which is a common way of looking at me. He did it like twice. And after the practice session, I'm working on the back end of the car, changing something. I don't know what I was doing. And he come up to me very quietly, put his arm around me, and goes, hey, I finally opened up my eyes. Thanks.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. He was driving Formula One at the time, okay? You know, I'm a driver coach for a Formula One driver, okay? So.
Yeah, how about you, Rich Noop? What do you have to say about that?
Well, I ran there, I think, about five times without the chicane, and I, like Tommy, coming out of two, you're saying to yourself, my God, is this ever going to end? But Busby had coached me and said, make sure you leave room on the exit of four, because the car will, if you're in one that has enough speed, will actually kind of grow almost a lane because of the bump there. And I think the bump was caused from the old tunnel going underneath four and where registration was with Charlie Rainville and all that stuff.
A lot of tracks had that where there was a tunnel. Michigan had that.
Yeah, then I ran some pretty fast cars there without the chicane. And the first couple of times and trying to go through there and not let it breathe and stay in it, it clearly grabs your attention. And as you guys pointed out earlier, once you go through, I don't care what tunnel it is, you are at a place. I mean, it is massive. And a couple of years back, I went between three and four and just climbed from the bottom apron up. And I'm all in when you say just respect and take it in now, because I think the banking's 33 degrees and I'm a pilot too. And when you put a steep turn into an airplane, it loads. And I was sort of part of when all the tire failures were happening. And I think we all were having, whether you're in a 935 or a 512 Ferrari, we had to overspring them so they wouldn't get too much negative camber, because we were popping tires like, the end of the tire patch the size of a bicycle, when you're fully loaded through there.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you what, I've not boasted or anything, but at around 200 in this Ferrari I drove with a Danwitz, but those are kind of the days you only had one co-driver, maybe two. You had to be damn lined up pretty well for that pedal assembly, or else you knew who you could drive with for a 6 hour, and you knew who you really wanted to drive with for a 24 hour. But that load going through three and four with a car that's close to 200, I don't care who you are, it grabs you. You get used to it, yes, but coming up to it is a little bit of like, oh, crap. Yeah. Well, those are some of my thoughts anyway.
Let's have a station identification break, y'all.
Okay.
Dave says I have to do it, so we're going to do it.
Since when did we ever listen to Dave?
Huh?
When did we ever listen to Dave?
Well, Him the boss. And Dave says, this is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave, and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also on Internet Archive, archive.org, iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify. Download the app and listen on your phone, car radio, computer, or your tinfoil hat. Now, back to it.
Yeah.
Where were we?
Can I say a bit about the track before the bus stop? That was
the Le Mans. They call it Le Mans now.
It's the bus stop. Cut that crap out.
It's the bus stop. Yes, I know. Even Bo Barker will know you. It's the bus stop.
I know we had to run positive camber to make our tires last going through NASCAR 3 and 4, because the 935 was doing, I'd say 210 or so, 215. We were motoring down the track. There's no question about that. But I finally got the car so good for Peter that he could go around those two turns with one hand on the steering wheel and just no problem. But, boy, it took some work. Man, it took some work to get the suspension and the camber and the caster and everything else and the Ackerman angle. All of it had to be perfect. But it would do it. If you had it right, it would do it.
I had heard something, Jack, one time, that y'all had developed something in the rear transaxle, some locker unit, instead of a spool. And that made those cars where they were managed, like through the banking and stuff.
Oh, if you were a wimp, yeah, you could run a locker, and, you know, 90%, 80%, and the car was a lot easier to drive.
But, yeah.
I changed the anti-squat and the anti-dive around and worked with that and the Ackerman angle, and I didn't care. We could light up the tires. It was like, you know, Mark Donahue said about the 917, if you can keep the tires lit up from one corner to the next, you got enough horsepower. And that's kind of the way we looked at it, you know, because I wanted that car to hook up and go, and that's what it did, especially the 78 and 79 cars. Yeah, that was great. I enjoyed doing that. The only time we ever got beat when we beat ourselves.
That wasn't very often.
No, it wasn't.
More often than I wanted. I know that. But, you know, nobody wins all the time. Mm-hmm. Sure was nice, especially that 73 race. You know, everybody talks about us winning the 24-hour and how unusual it was. I'm not sure who would have won that race if Penske's car hadn't broken. It wasn't anything that they did. You know, the engine gave up on them. So it was going to be a really, really tough race for both of us. You know, we'd have been at it right till the end. And then, but then we went with an entirely different car to Sebring. That we'd gotten just a week before Sebring and won that race. And then we went off to Atlanta with another car that was brand new and won that race. And then we came back to Daytona for an Easter weekend race and won that one. So in 73, we went off to a really good start. First four races, we won all four races. That doesn't happen very often either.
No, y'all are lucky. You're lucky.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it has to be luck, you know. If I went to New York and picked up a car 2 weeks before Daytona, actually, I got back in Jacksonville at 2:30 in the morning on Sunday, the 20th of January. That's the first time we'd ever set eyes on that car that won Daytona. So we were lucky, yeah. And some of it came from having the flywheel come off at the runoff final in November of 72 and practice on a new engine. So we knew to fix that before we ever went to Daytona. And, you know, we knew what gear ratios we needed to have in it. So off we went and did the race. You know, that was probably one of the easiest 24 hours I ever did. We just really didn't have much problem. Spent 24 minutes in the pits in the whole 24 hours.
Good grief.
That doesn't
happen. Wait a minute. Jack, wait a minute.
no such, you know, luck is nothing more than when preparation meets opportunity, and you always had the best prepared cars out there. Well, no doubt about it.
Yeah. Sometimes
that was the luck.
Yeah. It's still, you can have the best prepared car in the world, but once you start the wheels rolling, then it changes over to be a lot to do with luck. You know?
Not really. Not really, Jack.
Yeah. Well, I've felt blessed to have some awful good help, and I had a really good time in my racing career. I don't think I'd be very good anymore. Just to talk about it. I can still do that.
Hey, Paul Kelly, we got a question here from the audience.
Hey!
A guy who
Go says, ahead.
Guy says he's never met you and doesn't know you, but you sound like you have been to every 24 hour ever. So tell us about a bad experience.
A couple. The Airjacks one time, I was one of the few times I was not feeling, I was running an M1, and we were leading the race for a long, long while. And we had an Airjack let go on us. And I, amazingly, it was like when I was taking one tire off, that thing came down. And if I had been up there, I would have broken my hand. You know, show yourself like that. That was here. We let it for 17 hours, and we blew a motor. Mm-hmm. And the next thing we know, Mazda has this great big, you know, Mazda wins Daytona. I've done 28 of them. Various fuel, fire bottle, you know, a lot of fueling. Other bad experiences, kind of hard. Yeah, the car that broke, that went up, yeah, that was really sad because that was such a great car and we were doing so well. Mm-hmm. The one year we broke like in the first hour of the race.
Oh.
Yeah, that happened. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I could say that, yeah, now Sebring's a different story, but all the years I've been to Daytona and the Rolex, I've had first and then third through 10th. I've actually had more really good runs than I have bad memories there, so which is really nice. So, sorry, not that many bad memories at that place.
No, just making a 24-hour race is an accomplishment, for sure.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I you know, I'll tell you, my two best races. One was when I won it with Frombecker. I helped build the refueling equipment, and I helped out there. And in '94, I was with a two frame car. Tommy built one of the cars years earlier. I got to get together with you later on, Tommy. And we both cars ran like 500. Laps. We finished like 6th and 8th in our GTO class out of about 25 cars, and we like 16th and 18th overall when they had about 65 cars. To me, that was my best year there doing that one because I did 45 fuel stops. I did all the fuel for the entire 24 hours for both cars. Yeah, I was exhausted after that race. Twin probes.
People don't think about it, but those of us that had to work on the car, we didn't do 24 hours. We were usually at the track at 6 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, you ran the whole race. It was over at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Then you had to load up, and you weren't back in your motel before 7 or 8 o'clock. So it wasn't 24 hours. It was really 48. Yeah.
It is.
It was really
good. It is.
We didn't have all the fancy motorhomes and all that. And, you know, we slept in a folding chair with a blanket over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're asleep, you got to be a little careful. The rest of the crew guys kind of, you know, ganging up on you and doing things to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, like taping it in a chair.
I wouldn't do that.
Wait a minute. They had that idea about me, and I was like, you're not. And there were all kinds of signs put on me, going, for sale, cheap, don't let this happen to you. All kinds of signs on me.
I got another question here for you drivers, Rick and then Tommy. How did you manage to stay awake for 24 hours?
Well, you didn't get much sleep. You would, my early years in 24 hours, you ran 3 hour stints. Nowadays, they don't do that, but you ran a full fuel load stint. It was 3 hours. Well, you had to be ready to go 30 minutes before the car was scheduled to come in. So consequently, at least 30 minutes before that, you were awake and getting yourself fresh. And then you go run, and your adrenaline, when you get out, your adrenaline's still pumping, just like you're driving. It takes, each hour or more to get your body calmed down where you think you can sleep. And then you go try to sleep. You don't get any sleep. And the next thing you know, they're coming to shake you to get up, because back then we ran three drivers. They're coming to shake you to get up. You got to get on deck. So you didn't really get much sleep, and it took you till middle of the night before your mind really ever felt like it wanted to sleep. But and then when the sun comes up, it's an all new deal. You don't even think about going to sleep.
How about you, Rick Noop?
I pretty much the same in terms of the adrenaline. I think the traffic management, being responsible in the car, and I did. I think three of those with just one other co-driver, and then the other time with two. The last one I did, I think there was four other co-drivers. So for me to stay awake and to be responsible in the car, it was kind of strange because the race used to start kind of late in the afternoon, I believe, so you're already up that whole day. And I believe now they've turned that around a little bit. But as the motorhomes and the racing teams that I was able to go with, especially during the prototypes and the 962s, we had motorhomes and that sort of thing. It wasn't anything like what it is today, but that's a long answer, but I think it's adrenaline and the ability to keep consistent, and the concentration is such because, as we mentioned earlier, that 3 and 4, even with the chicane, because the cars are so darn fast now, you have to have, I think it's a pilot's turn, the situation awareness and come up with a strategy to where it's okay to let a car go dive underneath you if it's necessary, because you'd rather be a second off rather than a car that comes in on the hook. Then all of a sudden, if you want to see some dejection, you just look around your pit area. It's
Rick, can I have you come into one of my driver's meetings and say that?
I've never seen I've been real fortunate in some of the driver pairings I've had, and I really didn't have a problem, but you were clearly used up at the end of the event. I mean, especially in
that's an understatement,
corner.
Rick.
Yeah.
That's an understatement.
Well, there was a statement told to me one time. Well, I don't know what team it was, but it said one of the first rules of 24-hour racing is you don't race.
Yeah.
You don't wheel the wheel going into corners and you don't take unnecessary risks. You obviously got to finish them.
Yeah. I've always said the race actually starts at daybreak. You survive the night, and when sun comes up,
that's when you really start to race.
Yep. You know, this is Rick again. I agree with you guys. Once that sun comes up and you've got enough car because you've really taken care of it, then you can, it's the race almost is like a volume switch. You know, we all start kind of grabbing a little bit more, you know, we get crisper and you just, and I think when I started, when the sun came up, because the lights that CBA had, and we used to crisscross the inside lights for apex identification, and then we'd have the outside span the length of a football field. It was really dark back then, and the faster you went, holy crap. So I don't know. It's a feeling, and I think we're all in on this, man. Once you get under that tunnel and you look at it, you go, holy crap. It still grabs me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't that daylight light either, at all back then.
Mm-hmm.
Just writing on my doing time and scoring and trying to get my numbers in the right place. I couldn't see what the flip there, but I'll tell you what, I froze my tail off a couple of times.
That
it's
goes
cold
without,
in Florida, doesn't it?
It gets. I've driven for a team out of Michigan a number of times there, and. You know, 3 o'clock in the morning, those guys are about to die because they're freezing. And you know, it's 40 degrees, but it's a wet
and
cold.
And the wind, and it's raining, and it's all of that.
Yeah. And I said, dang, guys, y'all from the north ought to be used to this cold. They say, no, this is a different kind of cold down here. It starts in your bones and this goes to your skin.
Yep. A bottle of peppermint. Hey, a bottle of peppermint schnapps in the fence helps out a lot.
Yeah, well, you're one of the fortunate ones.
Hey, another question here from the audience. For all of you guys, I guess, how about a comparison of the other big ovals that you ran against the races at Talladega or Ontario or Pocono? How did any of those compare with Daytona, even though they weren't 24 hours? But driving on
they
that-
don't.
They
don't.
No, not even close.
Not even close.
Yeah. I loved racing at Talladega. It was all the thrills of Daytona, and it was a lot safer. Yeah. The infield was safer. Everything worked better at Talladega. It was just there to relax compared to Daytona. No. You know, the other places you're talking about, like Riverside and Ontario and Mid-Ohio, and, you know, they were at the most six-hour races. Even Sebring at 12-hour. Once it, you know, the first few years of the race down there, I began there in 1960. You know, we didn't even, the only pit wall there was with hay bales. So sometimes, you know, every race we ended up crashing into somebody in the pits, and there were fires all the time and all that. So, you know, that's where the real changes come about, and the real differences is how well the tracks adapted and improved safety-wise, and the cars did. And I never, in my whole racing career, I never wore a driver's suit except when I drove. You know, when I did it in the vintage racing in the 80s. But no, we just wore regular clothes in the pits. You know, tennis shoes and whatever we wanted to wear, nothing flame-proof. In the beginning, we weren't even any fuel cells, you know. So I think the first car we had with a fuel cell was that we ran in 69. You know, and then it was a NASCAR fuel cell. So but as far as what's the track, Daytona's by itself. It really is, with the history, the tradition, the, you know, everything about it is special. No question.
Yeah. No doubt.
Sebring is good, but not Daytona.
Okay. Any last questions here, Trish?
I don't know. How's everybody doing?
Good.
I'm good. Enjoying. This is fun.
Yeah. I told you it would be.
When Rick talked about being a pilot and talking about being situational awareness, I'm a pilot also. But I got to thinking about, you know, people are always asking me, how did I learn to race and prepare the car and do all that? And I keep forgetting the fact that my first training was as an aviation machinist mate in the Navy, working on mostly R2800s and R3350s and, doing maintenance on fighter planes. And when everything was, you know, it was life and death. If you made a mistake, you were in big trouble. But I learned that, you know, most everything you do, you need to have somebody check behind you. You don't ever think you can go without making a mistake, because you're going to make them. And we even practice that sort of same sort of thing like we're talking about now. I would never in any war zone, but I certainly practice for being in war zones. We'd send the planes out, and they'd fly 2 hours, go practice bombing or whatever, and come back. And we had turnaround times where we tried to get them ready to go again in 30 minutes. And in between time, we were sleeping on the runways with fire bottles under us for a pillow. And that was where I really got my training and where I got my feelings for how to would and should do racing. And I think most of the successful teams do it that way. Yeah.
Well, you guys are all legends in racing. We're glad to have you here.
For sure.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
In a couple of months, in April, me and my wife, we're going to be in Daytona for a couple of weekends racing. We're going to try to get her two grandsons to come to the Speedway. It'll be the first time they've ever been there. They're both in their teens. And let them come see this place that I always talk about and they always hear about on TV. They only live about 20 minutes away. Never been there. We're going to bring them over there and let them see it. Let them experience it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I'm sure they're going to be wide-eyed when they see this place, when they go through the tunnel.
I hope so, too. It's definitely different.
Yeah. Yeah, and anybody out there listening, believe me, come to the Rolex. There's two places you really want to stand, and they're up in the grandstand. One is between Bank 4 and the Trioval. As the cars come through at night, they look like jet fighters going through the Trioval. They sound like it. Yeah, they go through there, and it's just really awesome to watch these guys go through there because they really do look like jet fighters. And then you go over by in between turn 1 and turn 6, which are on and off the banking. Watch the cars, watch the brakes glow in the dark. I mean, they're bright orange. The first time you see, you think they're going to explode. You know, they're going to catch fire, and they just do a lap after lap after lap. Same way going up on 6, you think they're going to hit the wall as they come up onto the banking. Coming out of 6.
But both Amos Johnson and I think, said the most terrifying things we ever did was coming off the banking into turn 1 on these 4-inch wide BF Goodrich tires at 160 miles an hour in some crummy little sedan. A great experience. On that note, let's wrap it up there, Trish.
Really? We didn't get enough decal or bone. Yep. Bo or Decal have something they want to end this with.
If you ever get the chance to go see the Rolex, put them on your bucket list. You ever get a chance to tour that place, put it on your bucket. The International Motorsports Hall of Fame is fantastic. Well worth seeing.
I agree completely. Mark Raffoff, that is, and I were standing out behind Sebring Race Control today up on the tower watching the new GTP cars go by, and we're pretty amazed at visibly how much faster they are than the previous generation car. So it is quite a sight to behold in person. And one thing that I just wanted to add kind of on a personal note is that I'm open about Mr. Rick Nuke being one of my early racing heroes, because we met a long time ago at Sebring, but that's a Sebring story, so we might have to do a separate episode for that.
We will. Got to do it.
Yeah, we can do a Sebring show. That'd be a good experience for everybody. Well, I think everyone sees the windshield at Sebring more than once.
me having to live in daylight scared out of me at Sebring on pit lane.
Yeah.
That can happen for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. That was before the speed limits.
Okay, wrap it up, Trish.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much for all your great stories. I'm grateful for you being with us tonight. Thank you to our audience. They stand by us all the time. And thanks for listening. Our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on Racing History Project website. Next month, on March 15th, is a recap of past glory. IMSA's GTO, GTU, and Kelly American Challenge, with an assortment of guys who were there. Until then, good night, good luck, hang in there, and keep watching. Thank you. Night.